So I just read this book that touched the gardener in my soul so deeply. It's called The Fullness of Time, Marking the Day by Birdsong, Blooms, Shadows, and Stars. It was such a beautiful book about a topic that I think gardeners are more intuitively connected to than others, but society in general has become so disconnected to the art of telling time without a watch. Birds can tell us what time of day it is. What flowers are in bloom can tell us what season we're in. And our ancestors used to tell the time by nature. And that's just something so many people in today's world have like totally lost the plot on. And this beautiful book, The Fullness of Time by Kathy Haynes, talks about all of the different ways our ancestors kept time in their gardens and in nature. So I knew that I needed to have Kathy on the pod today to talk about this subtle art, really a lost art, that we can find for ourselves in our gardens and in our backyards, should we choose to. I definitely found the things that we discussed today something that I started noticing when I started gardening and getting more connected to being outdoors in my garden more. And I hope that you feel as connected to these aha moments that Kathy and I have in the conversation as I did. And I highly encourage you to read the book because as a gardener, as a plant lover, I think you will be very warmed by it the way I was. Without further ado, here's Kathy.
Welcome to the Growing Joy with Plants podcast, where we not only learn how to care for plants successfully, but how to simply and affordably use our plant babies to cultivate more joy in our lives by doing so. I'm Maria, former plant killer turned happy plant lady, author of Growing Joy, The Plant Lover's Guide to Cultivating Happiness, speaker, podcaster, and most importantly, your new best plant friend. On Growing Joy with Plants, you'll find conversations about houseplant care, gardening tutorials, and wellness through the lens of plants.
Kathy, welcome. You've written one of my most treasured books that I've read this year, I think.
Wow, that's amazing. Thank you so much. It's wonderful to be here.
Yeah, you know, a theme of the podcast this year, and I think a theme in the larger community of not just gardeners and houseplant parents, but people in general, is this like desire to go back to the way it was, this desire to grow your own food, and also like connecting to like the whimsical aspects of being outside. And when I was reading your book, I just really felt like, wow, the timing of this is so perfect because I think everyone is craving going back to simpler times. And it doesn't get more simple than rising and, you know, waking up and going to sleep with the sun and, you know, living in the rhythms of the way our ancestors did. And your book is so thoroughly researched. Just fascinating. I just learned so much.
So glad. Shall I tell you, shall I sort of let listeners know a little bit about what the book is and then we can dive into plants?
Yes, I would love
that. So, in a nutshell, the book is about the old ways that people had of marking times of day without complicated tools, without clocks or not relying on them. By the slant of a sunbeam or the call of a bird in the early morning or the motion of the stars, qualities of twilight. There's a chapter on songs and there's a chapter on plants. I knew before I started the book about a famous floral clock, which was a clock made out of living flowers. But then I just really got plunged into this exciting world of plants with rapid rhythmic movement. So I live in the city and one of the pleasures for me has been that sense of connecting with other species that I was kind of basically ignoring here. But also with what past generations would have noticed, you know, the rhythms of the day, the rhythms that would have shaped their day. And, you know, they call plants nap at noon or shepherd's clock and that kind of thing. So this, yeah, that's what I would love to talk to you about.
Yeah. So where did you get the idea for this book?
Well, I mean, it's really hard because it's been a long journey of fascination with all sorts of themes to do with time. But I have an early experience that I remember really resonated in about 2002. I grew an evening primrose in my backyard. And It's a plant a lot of people will be familiar with. It's from the Americas, but it's naturalized here. So you do find it in waysides. But this was in, you know, urban London, where life, the daily grind is pretty monotonous. And it's a 9-to-5. And I grew up on a farm where the rhythms of life and the rhythms of the year are very different. But I'm a very much a city person. Like, I love being in the city. But I had this, finally, this small plot that I could grow things in. One of the first plants was this evening primrose. And just sitting there and watching it in the evening unfurl the most beautiful, delicate, lemon yellow petals. Mm-hmm. And it sort of took maybe 20 to 30 minutes, but the final movement was really fast and really, really sort of exciting and quite intoxicating. And it would happen evening after evening. And, you know, it would put out this new bloom through the summer. And there was something so vital and ample about that experience. Mm. It was so different from kind of, you know, days spent at my desk staring at a screen that really captured my attention. So I think it started there. I mean, you know, as we can perhaps talk about it a little bit, I'm not thinking that people spent, you know, really spent a lot of time looking at plants to tell the time. That might have been part of the general mix of signs that people would work out the time of day by, like, you know, what the birds were doing and what the sky is doing. But what an amazing experience it is for us now to tune into these special kinds of plants with rapid daily movements, with predictable routines, really.
Yeah. And also, like, what is time? And the book really explores time in a bunch of different capacities. And one of them really, for me, being in exactly what you just explained, something that I think a lot of people, there is a reason why a lot of people garden, is it reminds you of a different tempo of life. That primrose is going to take 30 minutes to unfurl. Instead of our go, 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 execute, execute, how efficient can we be? Like, nature reminds you to slow down because nature moves at a slower pace for the most part. And we are nature and we used to move at a slower pace as well. And we've forgotten that pace because of all of the wonderful advancements in modern society. So I think also, like, not even just telling time, but experiencing time in a different way is really interesting through plants and through all of these different things that you talk about in your book. Frankly, I mean, I loved your chapter on plants. I thought it was fascinating, but I also loved your, I liked your other chapters on shadows and birdsong and all of these other things because we're out in our gardens and we're noticing all of these other, you know, signals that our ancestors used to use because we've been so dependent on clocks that we've not needed to be dependent on all of these natural cues. So can you go through the history a little bit of back before clocks were involved? Like, how did we used to experience time? And then how did this natural connection to circadian rhythms kind of be taken from us by the invention of, you know, the sundial and then the clock and all of these things? Like, can you kind of walk us through? Because your book is so rich with research.
I mean, it is such a complicated story. Yeah. And like, you know, what is time? I mean, so many, but it's really sort of like indefinable. And also one of the things that I found in the book was that actually people were still using these old signs of the time, even when there were clocks everywhere. So there's a sort of really interesting mix that's only been in perhaps recent decades that we've really withdrawn from, that we've really started running our lives so tightly to the clock and now so immersed in the screen, so distracted from by the screen that we're holding in our hand, that we're not noticing these other rhythms. But I think if we, you know, like your listeners are living an outdoor life, so then you start to naturally tune into those small events that happen. So some lovely things I found out through, because I wanted to know how ordinary people like me who don't have a kind of astronomy background or a math degree or the medieval equivalent would have told time of day without a clock or without something really kind of sophisticated, like an astrolabe or whatever. Mm-hmm. And there are some wonderful examples of people making sundials out of sticks in the turf. Shepherds, English shepherds in the early 20th century were still just putting sticks in the grass as they walk the sheep walks and kind of making these very basic sundials. There is a long tradition of people working out the time of day by the length of their own shadow as well as the direction of the shadow. And so there are sort of lots of beautiful ways of using your own body and the connection of your own body to the light and connection of your own body to the landscape around you, marking time by where the sun was over a particular landmark or, you know, where shadows are pointing. So the book itself is a series of different chapters focused on different themes. So there's one about the kind of rhythms. I really wanted to find out what we might gain from tuning into these kinds of rhythms too. So there's one on rhythms of fellow creatures. To give you a snippet, one of the things I read was that back in, you know, a couple of hundred, 300, 400 years ago, it was said that working people in the countryside they would start very early in the morning, but not until the cock had crowed, the rooster crowed, the time of time known as cockcrow in the morning, which is before dawn, so in the early hours of the morning. And partly that was because it was thought that the sound of cockcrow would prompt the evil midnight spirits to disperse. So, you know, it isn't just, we think of the clock, the units of the clock as abstract and empty. And there are all these beautiful sort of meanings, and not necessarily beautiful, but meanings and qualities and ideas associated with each part of the day. And these are points and phases that aren't necessarily equally staggered. So as your listeners will know, there are a series of really rich and intense kind of surge of signs of the time around the end of the day and the beginning of the day. So the sky colors change, birds sing more intensely depending on the season, and the first stars come out. And people had, I mean, what's interesting is some of these old ways of telling time stayed around for a very long time. A very old way of marking a particular point in twilight was to see whether you could still recognize faces. And in the morning, there is a medieval rule for a particular craft in Paris that they should start work when you can start to recognize faces in the street. And I found examples of that from all sorts of different cultures. So many of these ways of sensing time and sort of navigating your way through the day and by stars moving over a landmark or that kind of thing are based on your own body in space and your own senses reaching out, where we focus very intensely on clocks and screens and you know, kind of very instrumental about that. These old methods are very much about looking at the world around us and this great, you know, this much bigger world beyond our human indoor bubble and sort of sensing what's going on in the land and sky. So
there's an element of your brain here too, right? Because it's listening for the cock crow and then understanding, okay, it's right before dawn. Hearing the bird song in the morning and the evening and understanding, seeing the sun right above you and then move across the sky. And then there's an internalization of that in our bodies and in our minds, where when you're just looking at your phone clock, you trust that that's the time and you look at it and then the time is over. But there's a participation.
I love that.
Human participation in the telling of time that has been lost with the clock. Let's talk about birds, because I'm a bird lady. I love birds. And I am so curious about this because, you know, you talk about an ornithological
clock. I know.
Ornithological clock, and how you really can tell the time through the birds. And I think one of the things as gardeners is, yeah, we love gardening and we start because we want to grow flowers and food. But then one of our favorite parts of gardening ends up being the birds that come to our, you know, gardens because of the flowers. So can you talk a little bit about the ornithological clock and what we might want to heighten our sensitivities to when we're in the garden to notice?
Yeah, I mean, this is an amazing sort of story, I think. I found this article that was repeated in lots of UK and North American journals in like the middle of the 19th century, that a German woodsman had invented an ornithological clock, and they gave the timings of particular birds, some of which I can't quite work out what they would have been, in half an hour, like as if they kind of came in at half an hour intervals exactly. And this was repeated over and over. And it was really curious to me because, of course, wild birds aren't that exact. I mean, lots of the ways of telling time that we're looking at in the book are rough and kind of, you know, and fairly unreliable because it really depends on the weather and the season and all of those sorts of things. But so that fascinated me that it became so widely reported that he'd invented this clock. But I also looked into what ornithologists describe now, and there is a kind of broadly predictable sequence of which birds are going to sing first, typically. Not always. I mean, it massively depends on the environment, influences like moonlight and the weather and time of year and when the sun's coming up and all the rest of it. But birds that see better in darkness tend to sing first. So that's European robin and blackbird over here. And a skylark over here will often be among the early singers as well, perhaps for different reasons. And then other birds will come in later. And so you do get this kind of starting off with 1, 2, 3, and then it building and then becoming this group chorus that's so intense. And your early morning gardeners will kind of know that experience often of just this time of year, depending on where you live, because obviously the kind of geographic zone and so on affects it. But it is one of the most overwhelming and beautiful things you can, you know, it is so invigorating. Like that feeling can last the whole day, if not days. And one of the things I've been doing as an amateur thrill seeker, as I'm liking to call myself,
is that I've been using
the sense, because before that beautiful sort of overwhelming sound was like a chaos of sound. Now I'm trying to learn the individual singers by listening for when they come in and when they drop, fall away again.
So plant friends, we're looking at the end of the growing season as summer starts winding down. And sometimes people think, okay, I'm throwing my hands up and I'm quitting. I'm not taking care of my garden anymore. But late August is actually a great time to give your plants one more boost of fertilizer before they wind down for the summer. And that's where Espoma Organic comes in. They have a line of organic fertilizers that is so good, tailored to whatever you're growing. They have this complete line of organic plant foods that is designed to nourish your plants naturally, formulas designed specifically for what they're fertilizing. So they have a vegetable formula, a flower formula, a tree formula, a lawn formula, a berry formula. Whatever you're growing, they have a specific fertilizer for it, and they call their fertilizers their tones. They're granules that you sprinkle over the soil and then water into your plants. And because they're made with natural ingredients, they really support a healthy, robust soil. If you're more into the liquid vibe and you want a liquid to pour into your watering can, you can absolutely go that way as well. They have liquid fertilizers of most of their tones as well. So before you put your pruners away and you throw your hands up with that end of season exhaustion, give your plants one more fertilization before you call it quits and do it with Espoma Organic. To learn more about all of the different tones and fertilizers that they have, you can go to espoma.com, or you can also go to the link in the show notes, which is a link to the Amazon storefront that I have for Espoma with all of my favorite fertilizers and other Espoma products. Thanks, Espoma.
And so, yeah, knowing about the ornithological clock, it's not going to get me to the train on time.
Right.
Because it's so fluid, you know, there is a fluidity, obviously, to it and an inconsistency, but a rise and fall with the seasons. But there is such a pleasure in kind of listening out for, oh, yeah, the blackbird started them this morning. And then when the wren comes in, and then the blue-tit and the chaffinch and the dunnock, and, you know, it's just. Yeah, getting to know them.
And that's a very, once again, talking about participation, like if we want to increase our participation with the natural world, like that is a very simple thing that we can start tuning our ears to. And I don't know if you have this in the UK, but in the States, we have this incredible app called the Merlin ID app.
Yes.
I mean, they should be paying me for how much I talk about this app on my show. They are not. This is unsponsored. But it's so easy. Like when I lived in the Catskills, and I literally lived in the woods, like I lived it surrounded by woods. We had so much birdsong. It was incredible. I would just sit out on my balcony at night. I would turn on the Merlin ID sound ID, and basically it just runs a recording that you're out there, and then it can identify the birdsong, and then it tells you what bird it is. And if you do that for a couple of weeks, like you learn which bird is what.
Yeah.
And then it's so cool that you don't need the app anymore. And, you know, it's an interesting thing. It's like you need the modern invention to then learn, to then forget the modern invention so you can be unplugged. But it's really beautiful. And I'm also, I'm pregnant. I'm in my third trimester. So I'm.
Congratulations.
Thank you. I'm in a season of not sleeping anymore. I'm in a season of like waking up at 2 o'clock to go to the bathroom and then like not really being able to go back to sleep. But it's been interesting because we have water in our backyard. So we have a lot of birds in our backyard. I've started noticing like the bird song that starts at 4 o'clock. And, you know, if I hear it, I'll check the phone to see what time it is. Cause I'm like, gosh, are we close to five? Are we close to sunrise? Like, what is this? And you do notice it's like the same in Florida. It's different birds than it was in obviously upstate New York, but yeah, it's just this like beautiful and once again, kind of whimsical, kind of mad, like fairy-like. You feel like a little woodland, like nymph trying to get the bird song, which is super fun.
It's so transporting. I mean, you mentioned there as well how kind of something like the Merlin app, which is absolutely incredible. Except I find here it always mistakes a bird called the chiff-chaff. So I've complemented it with there's a Collins bird guide app, which I don't know if it does the States, but oh my goodness, it's such a good app. And it gives you the, but so I'm trying to train myself. So in combination, quite amazing. One of the things I was thinking was that I'm using tech a fair amount to find these signals, these signs. Yeah. And with plants, the kind of plants that I talk about in that chapter about the floral clock and plants with predictable rhythms, daily rhythms, often happens really fast. And you kind of got to become a bit of a clock watcher sometimes to kind of remember to get out there at the right time and see this thing. So there's a funny interaction between, and I think your word participation is brilliant because it's that sense of connection and noticing and sensing. And that's the thing. It's kind of devoting your attention that this is what it's really about. It doesn't have to take any time.
Yeah.
Like you don't even have to necessarily slow down. You just need to be present. And that's what
you honestly don't even
marvelous.
Need. You don't even need to turn to the app or Google as long as you notice, right? So like as long as you notice the birds, you know, so many people, birdsong is white noise to them. They don't notice the birds in their neighborhood. And then once they get into gardening and get into plants, all of a sudden it's like they're hearing these birds for the first time. The birds have been there the whole time. But so I think even just the art of noticing these signals that I don't remember in your book when I was reading, you quoted some great poem or great book. I should have written it down, but it was like these signs and symbols, these signals from nature that people with watches in their pocket.
Oh, from a Thomas Hardy novels. Yeah, yeah. A couple of novels. I can't remember the full quote and I could look it up if you wanted.
No, it's okay. But it's, you know, once you have the clock and the watch, you don't need to listen for these signals anymore. So you don't know that they exist. But if you can forget the watch for a minute, you know, just to notice these things is a massive win. And I think that is important. Yeah. So anyway, birdsong. I love birdsong. Let's talk about now. So I love this concept of the ornithological clock. And obviously it's going to be a little different. Like your clock is going to be different than me. We have different birds, but it's so fascinating. And it's been fun to be noticing that. What about this? Let's talk about the flower clock because, you know, people are going to be interested to hear about this flower clock. Can you talk a little bit? We know who Linnaeus is because we learn plant Latin and we learn, you know, Linnaeus is the guy who created plant taxonomy. So I've done episodes on this before, but like the plant Latin, but he was a little bit of a nerd too. He was a little bit of this clock. He started this clock project, never quite finished it, but it's very interesting.
It's fascinating. And there's so much more to say, but I mean, you know, it was a pretty full chapter. But so Linnaeus, back in the middle of the 18th century, 1740s, starts experimenting with and cataloguing the timing of a very particular group of plants. A lot of them come from the Asteraceae, is that how you say it, family? So they are things like daisies and hawkbits and dandelions and chicory or Chicorium intibus. And he's noticing when they open. And he starts to kind of regiment them into a sort of neat list, like he did with all other species in his taxonomy. And he put this list out in Philosophia Botanica in 1751 and says that a floral clock should be worked out for any climate and any latitude or words to that effect. And this was incredibly exciting to people because he gave 40 plants and the hours at which he said they opened implying in his part of Sweden. So this is thrilling. You're given a plant list. And so the opportunity to, it's always been assumed that by a lot of the things that I've read, that he actually grew the plant clock, but it's thought that the floral clock, as it's known, but it's thought he actually didn't. He perhaps meant that it to be something that was a guide to the time out in the countryside. And it was one of his students who realized that it could be, proposed that it could be grown and then people try it ever since. So, and it's the kind of thing that still absolutely fascinates us. So that's one of the kind of things that I followed up was someone who in Bern University Botanic Garden in 2022, so Bern's in Switzerland, he attempted to grow a floral clock. So a working clock made of a circle, or in his case, a kind of really interesting crescent shapes. Plots of flowers which open at particular hours. And so I interviewed him about, you know, did it work? Because it is notoriously incredibly difficult to make plants, to make flowers do this. But he said they did pretty much after 2 summers of trialing and testing and experimenting, they did come up with something that more or less worked in the garden at Bern between May to September.
Oh my gosh. I would love to see like a time lapse of that. Do they have footage?
He has got footage. I don't know if it's up online at the moment, but there was some footage of this.
So if you were to watch a time lapse of this crescent clock, and it's two crescents, and you know, one side is during the day and one side's at night. Oh no, well that's different. But anyway, if we're watching this clock and we're watching a 24-hour time lapse of this clock, essentially the idea is every hour of the day or at different increments, an area of the clock is going to bloom. Essentially, these flowers, like if you've watched a dandelion before. The dandelion is closed in the morning and then it only opens when the sun's out and then it closes again. So you're going to see this, and you would probably only see this in a time lapse, not really in real time, but you're going to see this opening and closing of each flower moving throughout the garden or throughout this clock throughout the day, right? That's the thought.
That's the thought. That's the theory. And Sylvain got it. Sylvain Aubry at Bern, a botanic garden. Botanical garden did get this to work, but I think he found that the nighttime much harder. I mean, I think it was just they focused on the daylight hours because there are fewer nocturnal plants that they could grow there that will do this.
Yeah,
but yeah, the idea is that you know a flower would open at a particular hour and you'd know it's the hour. And I asked Sylvain whether it worked. And he was like, yes, some flowers are really good at this. A gazania was kind of able to stick to within a kind of half an hour window as long as the weather was good for much of the season. And other plants are not nearly so reliable. It's always been a dream. Botanists really got into it in the 19th century and then apparently kind of gave up on it because it was really hard to achieve, as far as I can tell from what I read. So what really excited me was that there are these plants literally outside in the pavement cracks in central London as I wander around that are moving and doing interesting things during the day that I had been completely oblivious of. So like say the dandelions. Dandelions are really short-lived, so they tend not, I think that they're not kind of the best plant for a floral clock. And in my book, I kind of, in the extensive endnotes, you know, quite a chocker with endnotes, that I've put a couple of books in there that if you're really interested in this stuff, you'll get the plant list. So, you know, and people who've tried to do this more recently. But what was really exciting for me was the idea that daisies, Bellis perennis, are out there. They get their name from daisy. The old English daisy is the meaning of daisy. So they are opening in the morning and closing in the evening. And they, you know, dull weather, they'll stay closed or they'll close up. But Chaucer wrote poetry that, you know, that kind of romanticizes this beautiful event of the day's eye opening. There's an episode in the book where this sort of cloud of blue chicory flower starts appearing one August in our local park. And by the evening, they've disappeared. So my friend Jamil had gone out and thinking, okay, well, the golden light's going to come in. You know, lots of gardeners know that the best time to photograph your garden at the beginning, end of the day. Right. When the light's so golden. And Jamil thought, I'm going to go out and capture this. But by the time he'd got out there and the light was so golden, all these blue flowers, which had created this kind of beautiful sea of blue, which he said were like, you know, as if reflecting the sky, had all closed up because that's what chicory blooms do. So it's really easy to miss these beautiful events because they're right in front of us.
Wow.
But they're so subtle.
Wow.
And yeah.
Right. You wouldn't necessarily notice if you're in the park one day and you see the blue chicory, you're like, oh, that's pretty. Blue chicory is out right now. But if you go back a week later and it's later in the evening and it's closed, you might just be like, oh, the chicory died off. Not the chicory. Yeah. Asleep right now because it's not in its blooming period. You mentioned daisies. Are there other, in case people want to kind of incorporate some more time-telling plants in their gardens, daisies would obviously be a simple one to include. Were there any other plants that stood out to you that are kind of easily accessible that people might be able to add? Morning glories come to mind because that's a plant.
Morning glory is a great one. Yeah, I mean, in the book that I've kind of, I don't know, I've put the Latin names, the scientific names of particular plants at the bottom of each page. I've tried to do that for every single one of these plants, which sometimes in the case of the daisy, it's you know, you're not going to be able to tell the clock hour necessarily by them, but it's that sense of the rhythm of the day and the rhythm of the light and connecting to this much bigger world. So ones that I think, I mean, a house plant that is a wonderful one, really easy to grow, is the purple shamrock.
Oh, Oxalis triangularis.
So, yeah, I mean, what a great plant that is. So Jamil and Shab, my neighbours who I talked a lot to, my friends, about this, I had given them a purple shamrock. And, you know, it really does, as Shab said, appear to to sleep at night.
Totally.
When you're starting to wind down too. So one of the questions that Sylvain was asking the people visiting his clock was, what kind of time does this give? And it's not rigid clock time, but it is time in tune with the world around it. So plants are very in tune with their pollinators and the light and warmth. And so, yeah.
I think another one, this just reminds me, my mom lives in Florida now, but when she used to live in New York, she would plant like 300 sunflowers in her front yard. Like she would plant a sunflower field in her front yard. And it was so fun. We lived with them in the pandemic and it was so fun to really see the girasole, move with the sun, the sunflower heads move from east to west every single day. Like that's another fun plant to add to your garden just for the sake of watching it follow the sun.
I mean, that is a brilliant example, which I should have come up with because it's also, I mean, it's difficult to recommend because different ecosystems and different locations are sensitive. So a plant that does well here might be invasive where you are and vice versa. So it's kind of really difficult. But we're also familiar with the sunflower. And the thing that really amazed me was that the fully mature flower doesn't actually move. It's the immature bud that moves. Mm. And so one of the stories that I follow up is about Athanasius Kircher, who was a kind of, a scientist before the word, who supposedly grew a sunflower clock. So he put out this idea. He was a great polymath, a great maker of instruments, and the first person to theorize that disease might be because of germs and not something like devilry, for example. He was kind of a great man of letters.
What a novel idea.
I know. Great. So, this is sort of 1630s and beyond. So he, and in Europe, so he, by that point, the sunflower is new to Europe, grown for thousands of years in the Americas and extracted, brought over here to where I am. And people started growing it, getting incredibly excited, layering loads and loads of symbolism onto this majestic plant. Mm-hmm. And so this kind of Athanasius Kircher started this idea that you could grow a fully grown sunflower, and if you liberated it from the soil by floating it in cork, that it would just follow the sun and you could create a clock out of that. And it turned out to not be true, but we still have this idea. And so anyway, I got in touch with a chronobiologist, Stacey Harmer, it's in the US, who's been doing a huge amount of research into sunflowers, and she explained to me how, the immature bud is moving with the sun, but then once the flower matures, it stays facing where the sun rises in the morning. Mm-hmm. And the theory is that it gets all the warmth and it invites the pollinators, the bees and so on, to kind of come on in. And then I was like, but why are all the sunflowers pointing in really weird directions where I live? And there are lots of reasons for that. There are different varieties, obviously, of Helianthus annuus. And the other reason is because I live in an area of very tall street, so it's quite possible that they're getting quite weak daylight signals, and then that is stopping them from developing a really strong sense of the orientation of sunrise, maybe. I'm not necessarily putting that perfectly, but anyway,
really interesting. But even just knowing that, fully mature sunflowers face east, like that's interesting, like understanding orientation. So another thing I wanted to ask you about, because this is also something gardeners know a lot about, is shadows and orientation of the sun and where you're putting your gardens. I mean, that's like the biggest thing is, where do you put your gardens? Where is the southern exposure and where is the shade? Right. And so obviously sundials are our like biggest kind of example of using shadow. But how did our ancestors used to use shadow to tell time?
Well, I guess, one of the oldest ways is the shrinking of a shadow or its direction. So the easiest time of day to tell is midday by the sun. So that's when the sun is at its highest point, local apparent noon. And it's really easy because shadows will always point along a north-south line. So if you were to draw a line in the ground, north to south, it will fall along that. But it will be shorter. That's at its shortest point during the day, and then it will grow longer as the day lengthens. Sorry, as the day goes on. And if you're not on the equator, then it's going to have a different length every day. So you can also tell the season by the length of the midday shadow. So the midday shadow is a kind of really big one. And if so, apparently in the early years of the European settlers coming to North America, they would mark a notch in a windowsill or on a porch of the shadow of a window frame or a pole where the midday shadow fell. And so you could pretty much, you know, orient your kind of activities, I guess, if you can see how close the shadow is coming to the midday line and then how far away it is in the afternoon. So, yeah, apparently I read this in a book that was published in the 1970s. There were still houses then in North America that had the old lines in them. So it's possible that these lines, these midday lines are still in your home somewhere, depending on how old it is. So that's a really important one. And then one of the things that I love finding out about was that people, you know, we know about the formal sundials and I find them quite intimidating because they're scientific, mathematical, kind of exact instruments these days. Mm-hmm. But back in the medieval period, in English churches especially, it seems, but they're finding them around Europe now, people were marking the roughest kind of sundials on the walls. And so they kind of jam a spike into the wall, do a bit of a rough circle, and then, you know, these very inexact lines under the shadows, gorgeous, and you can still find them. I went on a hunt with my partner Rosie around some medieval churches, or some bits left of medieval churches in southern England, and she's much better at finding stuff, so she kept finding them. But one of them, they're really hard to date, but one of them was 800 years old, and it's the most delicate, has been dated to, because they can figure out by the architecture, and it's just the fineness and the faintness of these lines. And as archaeologists point out, these are the touch of people. We will never know anything about these people other than that they marked this wall, and these you know, we don't even know exactly what these marked. They appear to mark times of day very often, but they could also have been a symbol of the shape of the day and a divine symbol. And they, yeah, all sorts of fascinating things to do with ways of seeing and experiencing the world and thinking about the world and thinking about time we can't necessarily grasp.
Wow.
So that's one. I could go on and on. There are ways of marking the landscape and landmarks within the type, naming landmarks for the time of day. That was a wonderful experience of going to Iceland, where the map is peppered with names of the time of day, like evening ruin and midday hill. And so if you were in a location, one particular farmstead, you would navigate the day by the sun moving over these landmarks. Presumably you wouldn't risk harming your eyes by looking at them, but you can tell where the sun is without looking near the sun. So just so many ways that people have.
That kind of reminds me of like Stonehenge or the pyramids, where like they're known to one day a year line up perfectly with the sunrise or the sunset. Like that this idea of orienting buildings and, you know, structures with the sunrise and sunset. And it really also, light pollution. I'm curious, I feel like the simplest way that we can orient ourselves with nature and the rhythms is by orienting ourselves with the sun. That's it, right? That's what nature does, is everything in nature is oriented with the sun. And because, especially if you live in an urban environment, I mean, I think about when I used to live in New York City and I had no shades on my windows and I had street lights outside of my window. So I was sleeping in light every night. You know, we've become so disconnected to that. So do you have advice for, I guess, people in urban environments, but also just like how to connect back to the sun? I mean, it's like so simple, but it's actually kind of hard to do because we don't realize how much light pollution we're living with every day.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, for me, because it looks quite bright out there, but actually I'm northwest facing in a flat that has window light only on one side. So I basically live in a cave.
Yeah.
And so actually I sort of have the opposite problem, because once we pull the curtains, it's just incredibly dark at all times. But the sunlight falls on the block of flats opposite, and it's starting to creep in the afternoon now into our backyard. And it's that sense of, oh, okay, we're through spring equinox. We're now going to get light. You know, I become much more sensitive to what happens over the year and over the day by the slant of sunbeams, by the colors of the light. And I just was completely oblivious. I mean, you know, when we moved into this flat, I was like, yeah, it'll be fine. No, it's north facing, Kathy. You're not going to, you know, you're never going to be able to mark your midday line. Mm-hmm. So that's one thing. And with I do try and turn my outdoor light off much more now, because I also realize the impact it has on other species.
The birds and the bats. Yeah, totally.
Exactly. And also my ability to see the stars, because now I have got into marking time by the stars, more or less loosely. Mm-hmm. So you can do it even in this incredibly overlit part of London. So I quite often stand in our car park, our parking lot outside, and my neighbors are like, what are you doing? Because I'm standing facing up at the sky in the middle of, you know, next to cars under bright light. But you can see enough bright stars here to loosely map times. And I'm much better at it at certain seasonal moments when, you know, and I've got it kind of in my head. But it is so beautiful to stand there and to realize that's not a helicopter. That's not a satellite. That is Jupiter. That is, Betelgeuse. And that's Orion's belt. And that tiny little fuzzy haze over that chimney pot, that's the Pleiades star cluster, the Seven Sisters. And I only know a few sort of, you know, easy things to recognize, but that sensation of the motion of the stars over the course of an evening or over the course of the seasons means that I have now connected with the night sky in a way that I never did. So I feel like I've kind of regained a connection with half the world, you know, just half of the darkness, half the sky. So
and it sounds like
looking beyond the street lamps.
Yeah, it sounds like you don't need to learn every single constellation. You can learn a couple of points in the sky that you can just orient to throughout time. Like you have that, you know, everybody learned where the Big Dipper was. You know, everybody learned how to identify the Big Dipper in you know, kindergarten or whenever we...
Glad you did.
Yeah. You didn't?
I don't think so. Even though I grew up in the countryside, we didn't really... do that in class. No,
we had like field trips to the planetarium I'm spoiled. I lived in the suburbs of New York City, so we would get on a school bus and go to the planetarium in New York City growing up. But you know, you do have that like Big Dipper reference in your book, how, you know, depending on how the Dipper is oriented, you know, depends on the time and the season. There's so many different ways to participate and reconnect. The lowest hanging fruit for you, for someone who feels really disconnected and maybe feels overwhelmed by this conversation, to be like, well, I can't learn all the birds and I can't learn all the shadows and all the constellations. Like, where would you recommend someone start?
That's such a great question, because I'm coming at this as a lay enthusiast who's going around and asking experts. And so I don't, you know, I've learned what's necessary. For me to kind of pick up the basics. I wanted to know what an ordinary person would know. And that's a bit of this and a bit of that. And obviously starting to notice the plants in your area, which is where I began. Suddenly I like started with the, oh, okay, so daisies are doing this thing. And I started doing haunting daisies and dandelions and goat's beard, which in some parts of the US, I think are used as meadow plants. They're native here. And they close around noon, around midday. So Tragopicon pratensis, I struggle to say that. But you start to notice, you start to get your eye in because you started to notice these plants. And then there are ornamental garden plants. Marigolds, the traditional pot marigold calendula, that's another great one. Those are the starting point for me, just noticing that rhythm and noticing, taking time to listen to the dawn chorus and then the dusk chorus in spring. There is a surge of bird song often in the evening as well. So it's just starting to pick these things up. And then, you know, I've started to deepen, so that I've got a chapter on twilight. And one of the things I suddenly realized is I quite often in the city see the Earth's shadow and the belt of Venus above it in the east. So when the sunset's happening in the west, you get this gray kind of belt of nothingness above the horizon. And above that, you sometimes get this pink hazy belt, and that's the belt of Venus. And it is amazingly observable in where I live, and I have just didn't know about it, but now I see it quite often whenever the clouds part. And you know, it's whatever takes your fancy, really. I'd say whatever takes your fancy and follow that. But for me it was those common everyday plants that you just see all the time. 4 o'clocks, that's another really common garden plant, Mirabilis jalapa. That purple shamrock, I just love it because it's just so big and blousy plant, isn't it? It's a real...
Have you ever eaten
it? Showtime plant. No, can you?
Yeah, so it's an edible plant and it actually has a very sour taste.
Ooh.
It tastes like sour Skittles, or like, it's very sour, but it is an edible plant and it is a fancy culinary, like almost an edible flower, but it's used sometimes in like fancy restaurants. So, next time you see your friend who has her shamrock plant, you guys should each take a bite of the petal and wince.
Yeah. I don't know if I dare, but yeah, brilliant.
Yeah. Well, I just think your book was such a fun read. I enjoyed it so much. I think it's a really fun book for gardeners to read because it's not a gardening book. It's not how to garden. It's a different perspective at the natural systems that we're trying so hard to connect with already by gardening. So where can people find you and where can people find this beautiful book of yours?
So my website is Cathy Haynes. So it's with a C and it's HAYNES.org. But actually it's being published by Riverhead Books on the 21st of April. It's The Fullness of Time, Marking the Day by Birdsong, Blooms, Shadows and Stars. And you can find it in all good bookshops.
In all everywhere all books good are bookshops. Sold. And we'll make sure
you
that we have
pre-order.
The link. We'll make sure
Thank
we have
so
the links
much.
To everything in the show notes.
All right, plant friends, if you're looking to reconnect, I highly suggest you grabbing this book. It's called The Fullness of Time by Cathy Haynes. It's such a sweet read. You could read a chapter a day. It's like each chapter stands on its own because it's a different theme. It's so sweet. And I think it'll help you reconnect even deeper with your garden and with nature as we move into the shifting of the season, which is another way to tell time. All of Cathy's info is going to be in the show notes. And I hope that this helps you zoom out and look at nature and the passing of time on a whole in a more romantic, whimsical way. And of course, that it helps you keep growing joy. Plant friend, thank you for tuning in today. It means so much to me that I get to be part of your planty journey. If you like what you heard, make sure you're subscribed to the show so you never miss an episode. We have so many incredible interviews and solo episodes on incredible houseplant and gardening topics that you will not want to miss this year. And while you're over there in the podcast player subscribing, why don't you click over to the review section of Growing Joy with Plants and leave us a review? Reviews are tremendously helpful for the growth of the podcast, so thanks in advance. If you're looking for more opportunities to grow as a plant parent with Growing Joy content, we've got so many options for you. First, I highly recommend you taking the Plant Parent Personality Test. It's free. It's super fun. It takes 3 minutes to complete. At the end of the test, you're going to get your plant parent personality profile and a curated list of plants, projects, and podcast episodes that are right up your alley, tailored just for you and your lifestyle, inspired by your results. The links are in the show notes. If you're looking to uplevel your plant parent game, I have so many free downloads on my website that I think could help you, like the Understanding Natural Light download or 9 different ways to green up your office space. If you'd like to support the show monetarily and help me bring the show to as many people as possible for free, you can head to our Patreon link in the show notes to learn more about our offerings. And finally, I invite you to come hang out with me and continue the planty conversation on social media on Instagram and TikTok. I'm Growing Joy with Maria. My DMs are always open if you have requests for topics or ideas for the show. Thank you again for listening. It is truly my honor and delight to help you keep blooming and keep growing joy.